Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling, well, maybe the biggest question there is, who are you? Who am I?
It sounds simple, but it's incredibly vast. If you actually crack open the Handbook of Social Psychology, the index has something like 60 entries just for the word self.
60. Wow. That density really tells you something, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. We're dealing with something profoundly complex here.
So our mission today isn't to, you know, list all 60. Instead, we're trying to synthesize perspectives. We've looked at philosophy, social psychology.
Right. Pulling from centuries of thought, but also decades of actual empirical research.
And the fundamental truth we want to explore, the one that really defines the modern view, is that who we are is just. It's completely tied up with our social world. Our groups.
That's the core thesis, really. You simply cannot consider the self without considering others. It's impossible. We're going to move from some of those classic, maybe more internal ideas.
Towards the modern social psych stuff.
Exactly. Towards the approaches that actually use experiments to test how the outside world shapes us.
Okay, let's unpack this synthesis then. Where do we start? The foundations.
Yeah, got to start with the foundations. William James, back in 1890, he did this fundamental thing of splitting the self.
Into the I and the me, right?
Precisely. The I is the knower, the subject, the bit that experiences and thinks.
Yeah.
The controller, sort of.
And the me?
The me is the self as known, the object of your own reflection. And James broke that me down further.
Okay.
There's the material self, our body, our possessions.
Mm-hmm.
The spiritual self, our inner consciousness, our values.
Yeah.
But for us, the crucial one is the social me.
The social me. So that's basically our reputation, how people see us.
It is. It's the sum of how we exist in the minds of others. But here's the kicker, the bit that really links James to modern thinking.
Go on.
He pointed out that our perception of what others think about us, that can be way more important than what they actually think.
Ah, okay. So it's not just reality. It's our interpretation of that social reality. We're kind of performing for this mirror we imagine others hold up.
Exactly. And that vulnerability, that sensitivity to the external, you see it popping up elsewhere too. Think about Freud.
Right. Freud, the id, the ego, the superego, always fighting it out internally.
Yeah, that constant internal conflict. The ego is the mediator, trying to balance that primal id with the moral superego.
The rational negotiator.
The rational negotiator, exactly. But what did Freud himself say about the ego? He explicitly stated, it's that part of the id which has been modified by the direct influence of the social world.
Huh. So even in Freud's deeply internal model, the outside world is shaping the core structure.
It gets its hooks in right from the start. It molds the operating system.
Okay, so James defines the parts. Freud shows the internal conflict. What about development? How does the social self emerge over time?
That brings us to Erik Erikson. He really zoomed in on adolescence, didn't he? That intense period where the question, who am I, just hits you full force.
The identity crisis.
The identity crisis. And Erikson argued that finding your way through that, resolving it healthily, leads to developing the virtue of fidelity.
And fidelity isn't just like being true to your friends.
It's deeper than that. It's the ability to commit, to sustain loyalties, even when things get complicated, when values clash, when society pulls you in different directions. It's about finding a coherent self that fits into the social world.
Okay. So James, Freud, Erikson, they all point to this fragmented, socially shaped self. Why then does popular culture cling so hard to this idea of the true self? You know, that single authentic core we just need to discover.
Oh, it's a really powerful narrative, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very rooted in humanistic psychology. And you see it everywhere.
Like Scrooge.
Exactly. Ebenezer Scrooge finding his true, generous self. Or Neo in The Matrix, shedding the illusion to find his genuine existence. It gives us hope, I think. Hope that underneath it all, we're fundamentally good, maybe covered up by bad experiences or social pressures.
But whether you believe in that single core or not, we all need mental shortcuts to deal with everything coming at us, socially speaking. We use schemas, right?
Absolutely. A schema is just a cognitive framework. A shortcut to organize information. Helps us process things faster. Apply that to yourself and you get a self schema.
A mental blueprint for me.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And like all schemas, they're heavily influenced by what society tells us is typical or expected.
Okay, give me an example.
Well, the sources mention the classic caricature of a university student, right? Young, parties hard, sleeps late, eats instant noodles.
Yeah, we all know that stereotype.
It's a very strong socially reinforced schema. But the irony is the data shows that picture is actually inaccurate for a huge number of students today. Many are older, working, have families. They don't fit that mold at all.
So the schema persists even when reality contradicts it.
It does. And if even people within that group sometimes struggle against that inaccurate blueprint, it really highlights the power of these social definitions over individual experience.
That power of social definition, that feels like the perfect segue into identity itself. Let's maybe clarify terms here. There's personal identity.
Right. That's the me stuff. Your unique traits, your preferences, maybe your kind, maybe you love sci-fi movies. That's personal.
And then there's social identity.
Which is huge. It's all the groups you belong to, your gender, your race, your job, your nationality, even the fact you support a particular football team.
And social identity theory, which really took off in the 70s, argues these two aren't separate things.
Not at all. They're completely intertwined. You can't really navigate the world without your social identities influencing how you act and how you're perceived.
The classic evidence for this, the real cornerstone, is Henri Tocqueville's work, isn't it? The minimal group paradigm.
Oh, absolutely foundational. Because it shows just how incredibly easily, how almost automatically, we start favoring our own group.
So what did he do?
He took adolescent boys and divided them into groups based on basically nothing. The most famous one is splitting them based on whether they said they preferred paintings by Klee or Kandinsky.
So totally arbitrary groups, no shared history, no actual interaction.
None whatsoever. Meaningless categories. Then he gave them tasks where they could allocate points or rewards to other anonymous participants, identified only by their group membership, Klee or Kandinsky.
And what happened? You'd think it wouldn't matter.
But it mattered hugely. They consistently gave more points to boys in their own group, in group favoritism, straight away.
Even though the groups meant nothing.
Even stranger, Tocqueville set it up so sometimes to make sure their group got more points than the other group, maximizing the relative difference they actually had to give fewer points overall.
Wait, so they'd choose an option where everyone gets less just so their group comes out ahead of the other group?
Precisely. They sacrificed absolute gain for relative advantage. Left resources on the table just to win against the outgroup.
Wow.
What's fascinating here is this really demonstrates a fundamental human drive. Tocqueville called it the need for positive distinctiveness.
Positive distinctiveness.
We don't just want to belong to groups. We need our groups to be distinct from other groups and positively distinct. We want our group, and therefore ourselves, to seem better than relevant comparison groups. It boosts our self-esteem.
Okay, that drive makes sense for, say, rival sports fans. What about real-world inequality? What if you belong to a group that society consistently labels as low status? How do you maintain a positive self-concept then?
That's a crucial question, and the theory addresses it. It suggests the strategies people use depend on how they perceive the situation, specifically focusing on two factors: permeability of group boundaries and the legitimacy of the status differences.
Okay, break those down. Permeability first.
Permeability is about whether you believe you can realistically leave your low-status group and join a higher-status one, if you think the boundaries are permeable.
You try to cross them.
Exactly. You pursue individual mobility. The classic example given is someone from a working-class background consciously changing their accent, their tastes, maybe seeking specific educational credentials, all aimed at being accepted into the middle or upper class. They believe they can move as an individual.
Okay, that makes sense. But what if the boundaries feel impermeable? You know, identities you can't just change, like race or sometimes gender.
Right. If you can't leave the group, then you look at the second factor, legitimacy. Do you see the status difference as fair and stable or unfair and potentially changeable?
And if you see it as legitimate, even if you're low status,
then people tend to use social creativity. They can't change their group status, so they mentally reframe things. Right. They might start emphasizing different dimensions of comparison where their group excels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe we're poorer, but our community is much tighter knit, or we have richer cultural traditions. They find ways to feel positive about their group despite the lower status on dominant dimensions.
Changing the rules of the comparison.
Precisely. But, and this is where it gets really dynamic.
Yeah.
What if the boundaries are impermeable and you see the status difference as illegitimate, unfair, unjust?
You can't leave, and you feel the system is rigged against your group.
That combination is the spark for social change strategies. It creates what the theory calls a cognitive alternative. You stop blaming individuals or accepting the status quo. You start seeing the system itself as the problem and believe change is possible.
And that leads to collective action.
Yes. People band together to challenge the existing hierarchy. The sources point to something like the hashtag MeToo movement as a powerful example. Mm-hmm. Women collectively challenging the perceived legitimacy of patriarchal power structures and demanding systemic change.
So our identification with groups drives everything from simple favoritism to large-scale social movements. And this idea of identification, it also reshapes how we understand classic studies of social influence, doesn't it? Like conformity.
Absolutely. Take Solomon Asch's famous line judgment studies from the 50s.
Where people had to say which line matched a standard line, but everyone else in the group gave the wrong answer.
Right. And the headline finding, we all remember, is that a huge percentage, something like 76%, conformed to the obviously wrong majority at least once.
Why do they do that?
Well, Asch identified two main reasons. One is informational influence. You genuinely start to doubt your own eyes and think, well, if they all see it that way, maybe they're right and I'm wrong.
Okay, trusting the group's judgment over your own.
But often more powerful is normative influence. You might know the group is wrong, but you go along anyway just to fit in, to avoid disapproval, ridicule, or being ostracized.
You conform to avoid the social cost of standing out.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the proof for how strong that normative pressure is. Mm-hmm. Asch ran a variation where participants wrote their answers down privately instead of saying them out loud.
Ah, so no risk of public disagreement.
Right. And what happened? Conformity plummeted, dropped to only about 12.5%. Take away the fear of social consequences, and most people stuck to their guns.
That fear of social judgment is potent, and it connects to how we maybe need to rethink Milgram's obedience studies, too. The traditional story is all about blind obedience, right? People just flipping a switch and following orders.
That's been the dominant narrative for decades, often tied to ideas like the banality of evil, that people become unthinking cogs in a machine, an agentic state.
But newer analyses suggest it's more complicated.
Much more complicated. These reinterpretations, looking closely at the archives, argue that obedience wasn't blind at all. It seems to depend heavily on whether the participant identified with the experimenter and the scientific goals of the study.
So it's not just orders or orders. It's, I believe in what we're doing here, and this authority figure represents that cause.
That seems to be closer to it. They weren't just obeying. They were actively cooperating in what they saw as a valuable, albeit difficult, scientific endeavor.
Is there specific evidence for that in Milgram's data?
Yes. Look at the prods the experimenter used to get people to continue shocking the learner. The most coercive one, the one that sounds most like a direct order prod 4. You have no other choice. You must go on.
That sounds pretty final.
It does. But guess what? It was the least effective prod. According to the analyses, nobody continued the experiment after receiving that specific command.
Seriously, the most direct order failed completely.
It seems so. People were much more likely to continue when the prods appealed to the scientific goals, reinforcing their identification with the project. When it became just a bald command stripping away their choice, they resisted.
That completely flips the script on Milgram. It's not mindless obedience. It's engaged followership based on identification.
Really reframes it. And that same idea, the crucial role of identification, not just roles or orders, helps us understand the psychology of tyranny, too. Compare Zimbardo's Stanford prison experiment.
The SPE, 1971. Infamous. Guards becoming brutal, prisoners breaking down. Zimbardo argued the situation, the roles themselves, caused the pathology, the bad barrel idea.
Right. Roles automatically lead to bad behavior. But then you have the later BBC prison study, the BPS. It tried to replicate some aspects, but it had very different results.
What happened?
In the BPS, the guards actually failed to form a strong, cohesive group identity. They didn't agree on how to exert authority. They felt uncomfortable with it.
So no automatic tyranny.
Quite the opposite. Because the guards were ineffective and lacked a shared identity, the prisoners developed a very strong sense of shared identity and purpose. They effectively organized, challenged the guards, and set up a kind of functional commune within the prison structure.
So the power dynamic flipped.
It did. And the conclusion from the BPS researchers, like Haslam and Riker, is that tyranny isn't automatic at all. It emerges only when people strongly identify with a group whose norms and goals actively promote hostility and oppression towards an outgroup. It's the shared identity and its content, not just the role, that fuels brutality.
Okay, so whether it's conforming, obeying, or engaging in tyranny, the underlying key seems to be identification with a group and its specific norms. That's powerful. Now, how does this apply when we know people don't just belong to one group? We all have multiple identities interacting.
Now we get into really crucial territory. We have to bring in Kimberly Crenshaw's framework of intersectionality, which she introduced back in 1989.
Intersectionality. What's the core idea?
The core idea is that for a long time, when we talked about inequality or identity, we tended to look at single categories. We talk about racism or sexism, classism or homophobia as separate things.
Like parallel tracks of disadvantage.
Exactly. Crenshaw pointed out that this completely misses the unique experiences of people who live at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities. The reality isn't just additive, it's qualitatively different.
Can you give an example?
The classic example Crenshaw used came from a legal case, DeGraff and Reed versus General Motors, back in 1976. A group of black women sued GM for discrimination. But GM's defense was basically, look, we hire black people, we have black men working here. And we hire women, we have white women working here. Because the court was only looking through a single lens at a time, race or gender, they couldn't see the specific discrimination happening to black women.
So the women fell through the cracks because their specific intersectional identity wasn't recognized by the system.
Precisely. The discrimination was only visible when you looked at race and gender simultaneously. The single-axis approach rendered their unique experience invisible. Identity isn't just stacking blocks, it's how those identities combine and interact within specific power structures.
That makes the picture much more complex, but also much more real. It reflects lived experience better.
It absolutely does. And, you know, this raises an important, maybe uncomfortable point about studying these things.
How so?
Well, if identity, status, and power are so fundamental, we also need to think about how they operate within the fields of social psychology itself. Among the researchers studying these very dynamics.
Turning the lens back on ourselves, essentially.
We have to. We talked about Henri Tajfel, the giant behind social identity theory and the minimal group studies. A refugee from Nazism, deeply committed to understanding prejudice.
Yeah, his work is foundational.
It is. But later accounts and research brought to light, quote, unacceptable behaviors towards female members of his lab.
Wow. That's difficult.
It is difficult. And the point isn't just about individual failings. It's about how even someone dedicated to fighting prejudice could have those behaviors enabled by the power structures he benefited from his status as a man, as a senior professor, within the academic hierarchy of the time.
So it's a stark illustration of how privilege and unequal power can operate even within groups supposedly committed to understanding and combating inequality.
Exactly. It's a sobering reminder that these dynamics are everywhere and we're all embedded within them, researchers included.
Okay, so wrapping this all together, what's the big takeaway from this deep dive? What should you, the listener, really hold on to?
I think the clearest message is that yourself, myself, it isn't some fixed little nugget inside us that we're born with. It's fundamentally social.
It's dynamic, constructed through our relationships, our group memberships.
And that social self drives so much our internal negotiations, how we compare ourselves, why we conform, why we sometimes obey, and even why we sometimes join together for collective action.
So, key points. The self is defined by social comparison and belonging. That drive for positive distinctiveness is huge.
Right. And identification is the absolute engine of social influence in conformity, obedience, resistance, tyranny.
And identity isn't simple. It's complex, it's intersectional, and it's always interacting with power.
Absolutely. Which brings us to a final thought, a challenge perhaps, derived from how our sources discuss these power dynamics. It flips the coin from disadvantage to advantage. It's about privilege.
How do the sources define privilege in this context?
There's a really neat, concise definition offered. If there is an experience that affects a group of people, but it's something that you don't have to think about, it's probably a privilege.
Things you take for granted because the system is set up in your favor along that particular dimension.
Precisely. So we've established everyone has multiple identities. The challenge for you, the listener, having explored how much group status and social definition matter, isn't just about recognizing your different identity categories.
It's about consciously recognizing the privileges attached to some of those identities.
Yes. Recognizing, as the sources suggest, that most of us are simultaneously navigating systems where we might be targets of oppression on one axis, but agents benefiting from privilege on another.
It's rarely just one or the other.
Almost never. So the final challenge is, use that awareness. Use the knowledge of those things you don't have to think about your privileges, not as a source of guilt, but as a tool. Use that unique perspective to better understand and maybe even challenge the status quo, working towards improving things for everyone. That's really putting the social self into action.